Lo, there do I see my father. Lo, there do I see my mother and my sisters and my brothers. Lo, there do I see the line of
my people. Back to the beginning.
Lo, they do call to me.
They bid me take my place among them.
In the halls of Valhalla,
where the brave
may live
forever.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. In this episode, we pick up with part two of Heroic Quest films. In part one, Jim Yelton of Midnight Entertainment and I talked about the two Conan the Barbarian movies from the 1980s. This time, we pick up with two more films that we love, in the same genre, Krull and the 13th Warrior. So without further ado, let's get back into the discussion. Here is Jim Yelton and me talking about Krull. Well, let's see. We've done the first two, and I guess let's roll over into our third one. We looked at 1982 and 1984. Now we're going to backtrack a year to 1983. These four movies all came out within about 2 years' time of each other.
On a distant planet, a great kingdom was ravaged by beings who came from the future to conquer the universe.
Bowen!
Now, the only survivors follow a doubtful seer and a throneless king.
They will hold her in the Black Fortress. You must have help.
Thieves, bandits, fighters and brawlers.
Desperate men. Those are the kind of men I need.
Well, you heard him. We are now an army.
At the end of an impossible journey, they must fight an invincible enemy.
Here's the knowledge you seek.
I shall be your king.
In the fortress, you will face more than the slayers.
What is about to happen to them could never have happened on Earth. Columbia Pictures presents A World Apart from Anything You Have Seen Before. Krull.
Krull. Now, the thing is, I had heard of Krull, the other Robert E. Howard property, one of the other Robert E. Howard properties, when this movie came out, and I was trying to figure out if this was a Conan-style Robert E. Howard story or something different. I mean, I guess this really is an original story, isn't it? I keep thinking it must connect to some book or some comic or some something. It just seems like it's got so many original ideas or so many strange ways of putting things together that it must have come from some other source. But do you know, is this an original story completely new for this movie?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's a completely original thing. And I think
you know, they were looking at it as having the best parts of Star Wars and Conan because it came out the year after Conan did. And I think they were really wanting to have a fantasy version of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And it kind of lines up that way with the way the story plays out.
Yeah.
It is definitely, you know, a young guy that has to go rescue a princess from, you know, an evil villain, and there's a fortress, and, you know, he has people that he has to get in his band to go help rescue the princess. And
you even have stormtroopers that can't shoot straight, and
right.
Yeah, it's and wizards and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It really was a bomb at the box office. It cost $45 to $50 million to make, and it earned $16.5 million. Wow. I mean, I know I saw it in the theater. Part of that $16.5 million is my money, but not much. Did you see it in the theater?
I did not see it in a theater. I saw it when it came out on cable. But, I mean, when it came out, there was a big push for it. And, you know, they had a video game and there were comic books. And, you know, I think the only thing they may not have had was action figures. I don't remember ever seeing action figures for it because I would have bought them. Because I love this movie. Yeah. I mean, it's one of my guilty pleasure movies. And it's one of those movies where I can tell people that I love it, but I can't explain in detail why. Like, there's no good reason for me to love this movie as much as I do.
One of the things that I like about it is it never holds back. It just comes up with these big gonzo ideas and just throws them out there. And I mean, just from the beginning, you know, like, the prophecy says that they shall rule their world and their son shall rule the galaxy. That's such a throwaway line. I mean, there's no spaceships in this movie. It's not like they're going to conquer, you know, they're not like they have a galactic empire like in Star Wars or anything. It's just saying that somehow after this movie is over, the son of the, or the child of the, yeah, their son shall go out and conquer the galaxy. I'm like, well, when do they make that movie? I want to see that story. But they just throw that out there as just, there's absolutely no reason for them to say that. But there's a lot of stuff in this movie that doesn't have to be in there, but it just seems cool, right? They just said, oh, just, yeah, a Cyclops. He's a good guy. Why not? Chuck him in there, you know. Just, there's just so many things in it. This movie, by the way, is known for Robbie Coltrane and Liam Neeson popping up early in their careers, along with a bunch of other pretty cool actors. Isn't that Freddie Jones, I think, I want to say, as the wizard guy? And it's also known that for the leading lady, Lysette Anthony, I believe they overdubbed her voice the entire movie.
Yeah, they did. And it's one of those things that it's almost like with Conan the Barbarian, because the guy that played Sobatai is dubbed throughout that entire movie. And don't know why, because I've heard Lisette Anthony's voice, and I don't know if it was just the performance she gave and they weren't happy with it or what, but yeah, she's dubbed throughout the entire movie.
That happened with a lot of leading ladies in Bond movies. We've been finding out while we've been doing the Bond series is that there's this one actress that has done the voices of like 7 or 8 different major female characters in Bond movies over the years. And I don't know exactly why that is either. I guess, like you say, it may just be that something about the performance wasn't quite what they wanted, and they knew that with this lady they could get that, you know, that dramatic line reading, and so they just kind of went with that. And maybe it's the same thing here. I don't know.
And it's so weird because that was a 60s, 70s, early 80s thing where they did that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people would be overdubbed throughout an entire movie. It wasn't just like a specific line reading that they needed to fix, or maybe the dialogue track was messed up when they were editing. Like, they do an entire performance, and it's just weird.
Yeah. The guy that wrote this, by the way, also wrote Any Which Way You Can, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., part of the Batman TV series, and Ice Pirates.
Now, see, that just right there.
There's your resume, boys and girls.
This guy knew what he was doing. This,
I swear, if I would have not been surprised to find out he co-wrote Buckaroo Banzai or something like that too, which by the way is another movie we need to talk about at some point, but probably not really today.
That's definitely not a Quest movie, but we do need to spend some time talking.
Well, it does have a little Dungeons and Dragons group. They're just in a different context, but yeah. So, this movie's all over the map. I mean, I love that they go on a quest. There's like that creepy spider web scene with the lady that's got it's been a while since I've seen this one. I watched the other three, but I haven't seen this one in a while. There's like a, hourglass, right? The sand is running through the hourglass. The guy's life's going to run out and he has to go in there and find some information before it runs out. And there's spiders and crap and, it's just creepy. There's all kinds of creepy stuff going on in this movie.
And that tells you, you know, that scene, I'm glad you brought it up because it shows how layered the story was for this because it's the prince's name is Colwyn and he's trying to find the princess that he was going to marry and her name's Lyssa. And they talk several times with the old wizard guy about how he knew somebody named Lyssa and that's his lost love. And, you know, you never really know what happened with him and Lyssa and his Lyssa when they were younger. You just know it didn't work out and she was not in the picture and he went off and became a hermit in the mountains or whatever. And then when they know that they have to find out where the Black Fortress is and the Widow of the Web's the only one that can tell them, he goes, and it turns out she's Lyssa.
Yeah.
Is Lyssa, and they have this, you know, reunion, and they talk about why he left and, you know, why they, you know, never ended up together. And the only way that she can stop this, you know, killer spider that roams the web is to break her hourglass. And he has to hold some of the sand in his hand while he's crawling along the web to get out. And it's just, it's one of those things that, effects-wise, it's not the coolest-looking thing because, you know, it's all stop-motion with the spider and everything, but it's just like another layer to the story that's kind of cool where they didn't have to throw that in.
Right.
But it just kind of makes his story a little bit more important, you know, that he had this reunion with his lost love and she was the one that had to give it the information to him and they both die. And
That's a really neat bit. That whole section is very cool and rises above a lot of the movie. And then you get the big confrontation at the end where basically the villain is like the fortress itself, right? I mean, the beast is the fortress. It's his body or something. They're going around inside his body trying to find the princess. And
the Black Fortress was like his, you know, you talked about how there weren't spaceships or, you know, they weren't going around the galaxy. The Black Fortress was his ship. The beast who was kind of like the bad guy.
Yeah.
Traveled the galaxy in his fortress and he would just pick it up and move it to another planet and it would, you know, land on the planet and, you know, they would run rampant over that planet until they decided to move on. And it was just, he would send out the slayers to go kill everybody. And I loved that because, you know, that was another part of layering the story where the Black Fortress moved every day to a different location on the planet. So they never knew where it was going to be. And, you know, that was part of the quest where they had to find out where the Black Fortress was going to be so they could go get it.
And they're in kind of a medieval, kind of an almost Excalibur-like world, you know, but they have magic, you know, but it's kind of scientific. It's never exactly clear, right? I mean, it's kind of science fictional, but it's kind of magical.
I kind of liked that where there wasn't an explanation for a lot of this. Was it magic or was it science or, you know, did they have technology that let them do some of this stuff? I mean, they never really explained it and it did have kind of like this medieval overtone to the whole thing, which was kind of cool.
Yeah. It's a very unique movie. There was never a sequel or anything like that, obviously with how it did. But I mean, it tries to be a lot of things.
You know, stuff just happens and you just accept it because of the kind of story it is. And it's just, they keep throwing stuff at you and it's like, oh, okay. You know, I'll go with that. And I mean, but there's so much little stuff. And I think one of the reasons why I love this movie so much is because, you know, to a person, the performances are all great amongst the cast. you know, some of the people you know or you've seen from other movies. And like we said, you know, Robbie Coltrane's in it and Liam Neeson's in it and Freddie Jones. And I mean, you've seen all these people in movies before. But even some of the people where they weren't in a lot of big movies, they still deliver like really good performances. And at the same time, some of the ideas they throw, like there's the Cyclops who they set up. Well, why are they all Cyclopses? Because the Beast made a deal with them to give them foresight so they could see the future, but trick them. And the only thing that they see is the time of their own death. So you've got the Cyclops character that throughout the entire adventure, you know, they play up the fact that he knows when he's going to die. And that's why he's kind of like this sullen, melancholy guy. And he still goes on the adventure with them. And I love there's a scene where they have to get the Fire Bearers to go to the Black Fortress because they find out where the Black Fortress is, but they can't get there by foot. So they have to find the Fire Bearers because that's the only beast that can get them there in time before it disappears again. And the Cyclops says he's not going to go with them because it's his time. And they all assume, okay, well, you know, he knows when his time to die is, so this is it. So he's going to stay behind. And then who shows up to save them when they get to the Black Fortress and the Slayers are all attacking them? Mm-hmm. But the said, you know, he's the one that, like, helps them fight their way into the Black Fortress. And it's just one of those, like, little character things where, you know, they didn't have to throw that in there, but it was just cool because they built it up from the time you first met that character early in the story.
Yeah, it really is a smart movie in a lot of ways. It's a lot of love, obviously, a lot of care, a lot of intelligence went into it, and I think it's underrated and undervalued.
It really is, yeah.
Okay,
there's all of those little things, and if you haven't seen Crawl, go find it because from a storytelling standpoint, it really shows you how to set stuff up early in a story that's going to pay off later in a story.
Yeah.
You know, character relationships or plot points or different things that you could build to that you don't have to telegraph everything. But it's just, you know, little neat character things.
Mm-hmm. And they add so much. I mean, it gives a lot of depth and color and fleshes things out that – it really is a movie that people need to see and go into it understanding. I mean, there's going to be stuff that with today's jaded eyesight, you know, your perceptions, there are going to be things you laugh at or think that's goofy or whatever. But if you look at it with an open mind and realize it came from 1983 and just kind of came out of nowhere, you know, it's not a big franchise.
It wasn't based on anything.
Right.
You know, it was like Star Wars coming out in 77 where it wasn't based on a comic book. It wasn't based on a novel. You know, there wasn't intellectual property that they made into a movie. I mean, this is all like fresh new stuff. And I mean, even though there are shades of other things that came before it, it still is. It's a new story. And it's just, you know, I wish there were more of that now.
Well, our last movie, we actually jumped quite a ways ahead, but it's one that I dearly love and wanted to make sure we got to include, and that's from 1999. Now,
he was fortunate to have the love of the most beautiful woman in the kingdom. Unfortunately, she was the king's wife, and he was banished forever.
Go with God.
You listening?
Now, this man of peace has wandered into a land at war against an enemy that comes without warning and leaves without a trace.
They are demons.
You must know that 13 men have been chosen to destroy this evil.
What the hell are you saying?
The 13th man is you.
Now, one man...
Tell them I am no warrior!
Who has never known courage.
Of that they are aware.
Will join 12 warriors.
I cannot lift this.
Grow stronger.
Who have never known fear.
Let's go, little brother.
I do not enjoy heights.
And become... become something he never dreamed possible.
Prepare yourself.
One of them. From Michael Crichton, author of Jurassic Park, and John McTiernan, director of Die Hard.
I am not a warrior. Very soon you will be.
The 13th Warrior.
Back around the same time that the previous three movies we've been talking about were coming out, around somewhere back in there, Michael Crichton, he of Jurassic Park and everything else fame, wrote a book called Eaters of the Dead. Now, the thing about Eaters of the Dead that was so unusual, well, it was a Michael Crichton movie that did not read like a screenplay, so that's part of it, but it was presented by Crichton as if he had found this ancient manuscript and just translated it into English. And it's purportedly written by an Arab who was exiled from ancient Baghdad and ended up in the company of 12 Vikings going off on a quest. But you start getting little clues that make you realize what story this actually is, because the chief of the Vikings is Bulvi, and spelled with a W and L's and B, you know, all that. And the menace they're going to face is the Vendel and the Vendel's mother. And when you realize, oh, this is a story about Vikings going to fight the Vendel and the Vendel's mother, you realize, what is this story, Jim?
It's Beowulf.
It is Beowulf, absolutely.
Really awesome.
But it's Beowulf told from the point of view of a different character. Beowulf is Bulvi, the king, son of Iliac, and he leads the quest. But it's almost like it's a story told from, say, it's almost like if we saw the Fellowship of the Ring entirely from the perspective of Legolas.
Right. Yeah.
Or Pippin, maybe, in a way, you know, kind of a little bit of both, I think. He's naive and kind of comedy relief at first, like Pippin, but he also has kind of that mystical knowledge that nobody else has, like Legolas, and becomes a good fighter in his own stylish way as compared to the brute force of the Vikings, you know, and they come to respect him, even though he's different. That's one of many things that I love about this movie, is that it's such a movie for appreciating differences and appreciating what different people can bring to the group. I mean, in a lot of these quest movies, they just sort of take for granted that they all work together like a team as soon as they come together. But in this movie, the first half of the movie is integrating the Arab, Ahmed ibn Fahlan. I'm just going to call him the Arab. It's Antonio Banderas.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. It's just Antonio.
It's Antonio, right. But the first half of the movie is integrating him into the little fellowship in a functional way, right? We see that he learns their language very cleverly. We see that he demonstrates that his little miniature horse is actually good in its own way. Your dog can jump, you know. We see that he has his sword cut down into a scimitar, so he can actually, he couldn't even lift, you know. When Hergr, the Viking that's like his buddy that translates for him, when Hergr gives him the big Viking sword, he drops it in the water. He's like, I cannot lift this. And Hergr says, grow stronger. But instead, he uses his brain. He has a metal worker cut it down into a lot smaller blade, but it's well balanced. He can flip it and spin it, and he can fight with it. So, you know, over and over, we see the differences between these 12 hulking Vikings, who are more noble than you first realize, interacting with this Arab who at first seems very hapless, but ends up proving himself his own ways. He brings his own strengths to the table, and they integrate. That's what I love about this movie. Now, I've hogged enough time. You tell me, what do you think of when you think about this movie? How does it always struck you?
Well, no, I mean, you hit everything that I like about this movie. And, you know, it's the first time that you see it, it really does take you by surprise, the approach they take to the story, because like you said, I mean, it's a stereotypical fish out of water. We take this Arab and put him in the middle of these Vikings, and obviously there are differences, but the fact that, you know, they make no bones about the fact that he doesn't understand how their language works. You know, he doesn't speak their language and he doesn't understand what they're saying, but he's intelligent and he can pick stuff up as he spends time with them, and he learns their language and is able to talk to them. And I love how they do that in the movie, because, you know, they do speak a different language up until the point that he understands what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Once he understands their language, then everybody speaks English.
Yeah, that's great. That's kind of the way that Hunt for Red October did it with Russian.
Right.
It's a neat idea.
And I just love that, because, you know, there's the scenes where they're traveling and he's just sitting there around the campfire just listening to them. And just, you know, you can see that he's paying attention to when they say certain words, they're holding certain objects, or they're pointing at each other when they call each other by name, or, you know, that sort of thing. And I just love how they did that, because I don't know that I've ever seen another movie or seen another book do that, where they go through the process of a character learning how to interact with a completely different people.
Yeah.
And, you know, then, like you said, the genius storytelling conceit of, we're not just telling you a story about this fish out of water Arab with Vikings. Now we're going to throw Beowulf on top of that. I just love that, because, you know, then you get the stereotypical quest story where, you know, the outsider has to help the Vikings in their fight with the Eaters of the Dead, and they have to figure out who are these, you know, creatures that keep attacking them and how do they fight them and that sort of thing. And it's just, considering that it came from Michael Crichton, it doesn't surprise me how intelligent it was and how well done it was. But just the layering of that story on top of Antonio Banderas dealing with these Vikings was just really cool. And, you know, like I said, you know, it's one of those things that you don't really appreciate until you get about halfway into the movie and you realize what's going on. And I hate ruining it for people that haven't seen it, but, you know, you almost have to tell them, because I think a lot of people, and I think the reason why it maybe didn't do as well at the box office is because they didn't really do a good job marketing it.
No.
And, you know, you don't really, you know, if you look at the trailers or you look at the marketing they did for it, it seems like they're marketing a very different movie.
Yeah. Oh, they're playing like Enigma dance music in the trailer. I'm sure if I haven't already, I'm about to play the trailer for it, and you guys will see or have already seen what I mean. But every marketing thing I saw for it stresses the first 5 seconds of the movie. Like, he was a poet in the most beautiful city on earth, and then he has this run-in with the caliph's wife, or the wife of a powerful man, and the caliph sends him into blah, blah, blah. I'm like, that's like the first 5 seconds of the movie.
Yeah.
What you need to say is there's cannibal monsters, there're cannibal cavemen attacking a village, and he joins with 12 Vikings to go fight them and go down in the cave and root them out and everything. I mean, they acted like it was an Antonio Banderas romantic comedy. And I just don't understand how they ever, I guess they thought that was the only people that were going to go see it. But
yeah, it, you know, they didn't even really have to hit on the connection to the Beowulf legend. Mm-hmm. If they just keyed in on, here's this adventure story about this Arab who's in a strange land, who hooks up with Vikings, and they end up having to fight these kind of, you know, almost, you know, mythological creatures who are attacking the Vikings, that's enough to sell the story. The really cool part about the story is when you start to realize that they aren't, you know, these, you know, kind of creatures of legend, that they're just kind of going like one step past where we are and saying, well, they're some sort of humanoid cannibals of some kind. We don't know what they are. We just know that they're creatures that attack us.
Yeah. And, the theory is that they're the last of the Neanderthals.
Right, exactly. And that's what I was going to say. Like, I love that part too, that, you know, there could be some pockets of Neanderthals out there that, you know, just come out of the caves every once in a while and attack people, and that's what happens. And, you know, I love that they played that, and, you know, that grows into this legend that eventually becomes Beowulf, and it's just really cool.
Yeah. There's several things I do want to mention. The cast is wonderful. I mean, at the top, you got Antonio Banderas. Now, I would have preferred an Arab actor, but I guess, you know, the Arab actor who was in The Mummy as the good guy, you know, the guy with the tattoos.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name.
It's Oded Fehr.
Oded Fehr. He would have been great, except he's too much of a badass. You know, you almost needed bumbling little Antonio Banderas for the first half of this movie to sell the fact he didn't know what he's doing. Oded Fehr would have never come across as not knowing how to kill people.
Right.
So even though he's not remotely Arab, I guess it kind of works. He's kind of tan, whatever. But I'm going to use this word. He's very sweet in it. And I like that. I like that he is a hero. He learns to be a man. You know, the last line in the movie is that these barbarian Viking men taught me to be a man and to be a useful servant of God. I mean, I thought that was great. And so he has a sweetness about him all the way through it. And there's the Viking girl that takes to him that you know, gets with him, because I think she appreciates that too. These other guys are all big and tough and rough, and he's kind of sensitive. Yeah. But I mean, but in a cool way. I mean, he's a cool guy. Now, I have to say also, you get Omar Sharif on a camel. This movie was worth existing if for no other reason than to get Omar Sharif back on a camel again.
Oh, yeah.
After Lawrence of Arabia.
And I've told people, you know, when I talk about this movie, I said, if that character was not in the book, they needed to write him in the movie just so Omar Sharif could be in the movie.
Yes.
I mean, make this movie and not have Omar Sharif as a part of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now you can't talk about this movie without talking about the horrific production situation that went through it. How much do you know about just what purgatory this movie went through before it finally got onto theater screens?
Well, I know quite a bit about the behind the scenes stuff, and I know that, you know, it didn't test well, and you know, the thing that surprises me is that this is John McTiernan coming off of, you know, Die Hard and Predator and, you know, huge movies where, you know, he kind of, you know, made his name. And this just seems like one of those movies that's like in his wheelhouse. So I don't know what movie he was trying to make that wasn't testing well, or maybe audiences just didn't get the concept to begin with.
Yeah, I've heard that his cut was unwatchable. I'd like to see it just to kind of know. Also, I've heard some of the Graham Revell original soundtrack, the original score, and it's nice, but the isn't it Horner that ended up doing the revised? Let me see.
Yeah.
I think it was.
What was Jerry Goldsmith?
Oh, Goldsmith. Well, Horner, Goldsmith, same thing basically. Yeah, Goldsmith, yeah. I mean, I dearly love the Jerry Goldsmith score for this movie. I have it on my iPhone, and I play it all the time. Just a fantastic score, because it's heroic. It's big and bold and heroic, which matches the Vikings and all the big goings-on. It's got lots of horns and drums and all. It's very similar in a way to the Conan score, kind of. And, yeah. I, you know, the original one was with the Graham Revell one was just sounded like it could have been any movie. And so I could see where without the right music, I mean, there's no movie that illustrates the power of music more than Star Wars, right? If you watch Star Wars without the music, they said people that saw it just turned to look at George Lucas and said, "I'm sorry," you know, whereas once you put that John Williams score on Star Wars, it's a different movie. And it's kind of the same thing here. You put this, Goldsmith score on this movie and it gives it oomph, you know. It gives it gravitas.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about doing a Michael Crichton movie is Michael Crichton's a director. And so, you know, and I think sometimes people forget that, you know, yeah, he wrote all of these really great books that ended up becoming really great movies, but he also directed, and at the point that this movie came out, he had been directing for, you know, 20 some odd years himself. So for him to look at a movie based on one of his books and say, yeah, this isn't working. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be able to go in and fix it myself if I have to. You know, that shows what kind of power he had at this point in time.
Well, and that's what he did. I got off on the music for a second, but I'll finish that story. Is that he looked at it and said, no, we gotta make some changes. And I'm going to put some clips from some of the extras that I found on various places on video. I'm going to mix in here during this portion.
I will call it a quest movie. And then after that, you know, Lord of the Rings and some other movies of that nature came out.
The way that worked is the way it often works in Hollywood. There was a book. There was Eaters of the Dead. I knew Michael Crichton's work real well. I was a fan of Crichton's. I'm still reading on his stuff.
I thought it had a problem to work as a story. It's interesting. I should have paid attention to my first intuition.
The film that you see, I'm proud to say, is with adjustments. The script that I'd recognize.
And that started with the use of real actors from the north of Europe. I mean, what we call real Vikings. He didn't accept the possibility of working with actors from Hollywood to do all those characters. So he did a very strong cast in the north of Europe with Norwegians and Swedish people. So they brought all these real actors with real accents from the north of Europe.
I had just moved to Los Angeles, and I had an agent who was lazy, so I fired my agent. And I had nobody. And a week later, the agent calls and says, there's some horror movie called Eaters of the Dead. They want some, you know, they want some big Nordic actors. So I went, and I had no idea it was a John McTiernan picture. They were very secretive about it. I had no idea it was a Michael Crichton novel. And so they just gave me a little piece to read, and it was really well written, maybe by that gentleman who just walked out. And I did that piece. I waited 3 months, and then they called. And they said, John McTiernan wants to meet you. He never meets with anybody, but he wants to meet with you. So I met with John. I was not the first choice. The studio didn't want me. Michael Crichton didn't want me. The only person who wanted me was McTiernan. They wanted Stellan Skarsgård, the Swedish actor. And so they cast it first in L.A., then in New York, then in Sweden, Stockholm, Toronto and Vancouver. And then they came back to me 4 months later and gave me the role. As far as the rest of the guys, they did most of the casting in London and in Scandinavia because they wanted that quality, either British or Nordic, Scandinavian. And McTiernan never met anybody except for me because I was in Los Angeles. He didn't meet Dennis Storhoy, you know, who played that other wonderful role, Herger. He didn't meet any of the other characters. And I remember when we all ended up in Canada for the first night to, you know, get to know each other, it was the first time he saw all of the 13 actors. So it was pretty. And he was happy. I was watching his face because he said, I'm really nervous what these guys are really like because I'm just picking them off of tapes from around the world. And these guys were fantastic, you know.
From what I understand, they were actually McTiernan was filming stuff on one stage and Crichton was filming stuff on the other. And Crichton was telling the actors, just do whatever you want to do with him. We're not going to use it anyway. This is what we're going to use. I'm just like, how can you make a movie that way? And when you look at this movie, you can tell that Crichton, if I haven't made it clear yet, audience, I apologize, is that after McTiernan basically more or less finished the movie, Crichton went back and just totally redid the movie. I mean, redid whole sections of it, including the ending, including recasting parts. So there's actually like not just a McTiernan cut of this movie somewhere in the ether out there. There's a version with different actors and a different story. How strange is that?
Yeah, and that's why I say, I mean, I wonder how bad was the cut of this movie that Michael Crichton felt like, this isn't working. Mm. I have to go in there and, you know, roll up my sleeves and do this myself, because, you know, it wasn't like he just reshot a couple of scenes or they reshot the ending because the ending wasn't work. I mean, he went in and did major work on this movie, including, like you said, throwing out the entire original score and having Jerry Goldsmith come in and rescore it, you know, re-editing it. I mean, everything. So the movie that was released is, you know, wildly different than whatever John McTiernan was going to do in, you know, his first cut.
Yeah, and if you watch the movie carefully, it is uneven enough, it's rough around the edges enough that you can tell where they had to dub lines in, where they had to reshoot things, where they changed things. You can tell if you know what to look for. But I have to say this, I think it works. I mean, you know, would it be slightly better if Crichton had maybe directed the entire thing? Probably. There probably some of the scenes would be a little smoother, the transitions would be a little smoother. But I think everything's there that you need. I mean, I think that it works just fine with what they ended up with. But a lot of people disagree with me, and I understand. I mean, it was not a success. It cost about $160 million to make, and it grossed about $61 million domestically. Or, whoa, worldwide, God. So that was worldwide.
Yeah. So. You know, I still point to the fact that I know we've had this conversation both on podcasts and just off podcast personally between us. There are some movies that are just marketed badly.
Yeah.
And that kills it before it is even released. And then, you know, the other thing is
John Carter.
Right. Yeah. Don't get me started on John Carter. Yeah. But the other thing is it does depend on when the movie's released and what's it is up against, because 13th Warrior came out, I want to say, the same weekend The Sixth Sense came out. Hmm. And you remember, everybody was hyped about The Sixth Sense coming out just because of the twist ending. And, you know, it had Bruce Willis going for it. And, I mean, it was a fairly big movie. And then the second weekend, it was even bigger because word was starting to spread. You have to go see this movie. The twist is crazy. And I don't think it had a chance going up against The Sixth Sense. I mean, The 13th Warrior was pretty much dead in the water coming out that weekend.
Yeah, 1999 was quite a year. I mean, just think, you had The Matrix, you had The Phantom Menace. You know, those two alone just dominated the summer pretty much. Toy Story 2, The Sixth Sense, yeah, Fight Club, American Beauty won the Oscar. I mean, there was just a lot of big movies that came out that year, and it just kind of got swamped. I mean, it got delayed for a year before it even came out. But
it's an argument that I've been having off and on with people on Facebook and, you know, in blogs and different things, where, you know, they say, you know, the oversaturation of the summer movie season is going to kill movies, and I keep saying, well, people have been saying that for like 20 or 30 years.
Yeah,
I mean. You know, and this movie is a prime example of that. I mean, this was, what, 15, 16 years ago, and it just got bowled over by the competition that it was up against that summer. And the fact that the marketing didn't help it, you know, made it worse.
The one real criticism I have of this movie, I wish it had been a little bit longer and that they'd have had more time to develop the supporting characters, because you really don't get development of anybody except Antonio Banderas' character. You get some with Bullvi, and you get a lot with Dennis Storhoy as Herger, which I want to say one more thing about in a second. But all the other Vikings are pretty much vanilla. You get nothing about them, and you don't get enough of Omar Sharif's character because he's only in it from the very beginning. I'd have liked a little bit more there. Now, I imagine that Crichton probably wanted to just move. In fact, I'll bet you that the original version took a lot longer to get to the Vikings. Because if you watch the theatrical version, which is the only version available, if you watch it now, the first like 10 minutes of this movie is almost like a summary. You know, it's almost like a summary of a movie you didn't see, and this is the sequel. It's like, you know, here's what happened, and here's what happened, and here's what happened. He did this, he did this, he did this, and here's the Vikings. Now we're going to start the story. I mean, the movie doesn't really settle down to a normal pace until he wakes up in the Viking camp the second day, when they have the infamous spitting in the bowl scene. That's the beginning, really, of the movie. Everything up until then is like boom, 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 summary, summary, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it the pacing's a little off, and you know, I think they could have spent a little bit more time developing the characters before they got into, you know, them dealing with the creatures and that sort of thing. But you know, it was also knowing that it was an Antonio Banderas starring vehicle. I mean, they weren't going to spend a ton of time developing all of the Viking characters. I just knew that going in.
Yeah, that's true. We even get a little bit more about his girlfriend, Olga, than we do about any of the Vikings that actually get killed. So we don't care that much when they die other than, oh, man, there goes another Viking. They're running out of Vikings. You know, a little concerned. Now, I want to say the breakout star of this movie to me, I thought Antonio Banderas did a great job. I really love that character. But the breakout actor and character is, to me is Dennis Storhoy as Herger. And he should have gone on to be a major Hollywood star after this movie because he is so likable and his performance is so charismatic in this movie. I mean, I was going to say that there's probably 1,000 great lines in this movie. There's just so many good quotes that come out of this movie, and he gets about half of them. I mean, yeah. I love that character.
He gets the really fun part because he's I don't want to say sidekick because, you know, he's one of the Viking band, but he's really the first person that Antonio Banderas kind of bonds with. And, you know, he's the one that kind of helps Antonio Banderas acclimate himself to the Viking culture. And mm-hmm. he's the gateway to Viking culture for the Arab character. And so, you know, obviously he's going to have a little bit more of a fun part than some of the other ones. But yeah, he was great in this movie, and I was glad that they got somebody that could pull that off because it's really hard to straddle that line sometimes.
There's so many great moments, but a couple that occur to me is when they decide they need to kill crown prince's thugs to make the point that don't mess with us while we're here helping you. They pick out this big redheaded giant guy, and so Herger's job is to pick a fight with him. And so he keeps throwing mud on the guy, and the guy's trying not to, you know, and Herger's doing everything he can to pick a fight. And so finally the guy's like, I'll send you in the next world. And so they're going to have a duel, and everybody gathers around to watch the duel. And Antonio Banderas thinks, oh my God, my buddy Herger's going to get killed. I have to stop him. And he says, what happened? And Herger says, an engineering dispute. When he was throwing mud on the guy, an engineering dispute. And he goes, well, you can't fight him. He'll kill you. And Herger says, bet on him if you like. I mean, he just has so many just cute, fun, throwaway lines. Like he tells him, grow stronger when he can't pick up the sword. And you know, just he has so many moments that really he is like the heart of the movie. And like I said, I really thought he would be he would have some other big roles. I think he moved with his wife from Norway to Hollywood after this movie, thinking this was going to be his big moment, and it just didn't work out. It's a shame. So,
yeah, I'm sure a lot of people that were in this movie thought that too. But
yeah, they thought, hey, I'm in a movie with Antonio Banderas. I got a blank check now, but it just didn't quite work out. So, any other thoughts about the 13th Warrior?
I just look at it and say I can't recommend it enough to people who haven't seen it. It's kind of like, you know, we were talking about with Krull. Like, there's so many little nuanced character moments that they do really well, and things that I haven't seen in other movies that I was glad to see, like how they integrate Antonio Banderas into the Viking band and, you know, how they layer the Beowulf legend into it. I mean, it's just really cool stuff. And I mean, I don't think knowing that going in is going to ruin the movie for anybody because it's really cool how they do it. And I think it's a really cool movie for people to see if they haven't seen it.
Do you like the title they went with, The 13th Warrior, better, strategically at least in terms of marketing to the public, or would you rather be called the Eaters of the Dead?
No, I think that's one of the few things that they did right.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think Eaters of the Dead would have been a bigger hit. I think it would have been, you know, even less of a box office success than it already was. But
because it sounds like a horror movie, it doesn't sound like an adventure quest movie with Vikings to me.
Yeah, and even if they had played up the more horrific aspects of the cannibals in the marketing, Eaters of the Dead, I think, would have turned people off and made them think it was like a zombie movie or something. And
yeah,
the 13th Warrior really gets across the adventure aspect of it. I just wish the marketing had gotten across the adventure aspect of it as well as the title did.
Well, and one really unfortunate thing that I hate about it is that Hollywood, the studio and all, insisted that they totally downplay or eliminate almost that he was an Arab. And I really hate that because this was even in 1999. It was 2 years before 9/11. So this didn't have the excuse of coming out after 9/11 when they would wanted to, you know, just in terms of backlash or anything. They had no excuse. They just didn't want to emphasize that the protagonist of this movie was an Arab, even though his name is Ahmed Ibn Fahlan and he's got a black, you know, the headdress that he wears the first half of the movie. And, I mean, you know, he comes from Baghdad and all that. I mean, despite all that, they even didn't want the music to sound like Middle Eastern music. So the music is much more about the Vikings. There are some strains of kind of exotic, you know, Middle Eastern tunes that run through parts of the score. But most of the score sounds more like the Vikings than it does like the Arab. And again, I just think it's unfortunate that Hollywood continues to do things like that when they had the opportunity to present such a positive image. I mean, I'm surprised they even have him writing in Arabic at the end and mentions being a servant of God. That I'm surprised that got past the studio, honestly, which is unfortunate. But
yeah, and I think that's like the missed opportunity for me whenever I think about this movie is that, you know, very few times in Hollywood history do you get a character that's this kind of a character that's portrayed as a hero and, you know, mm-hmm. is smart and uses his intelligence and his wisdom to kind of go against the brutal nature of the Vikings. And, you know, he gets out of jams by thinking about it and not using brute force. And the fact that he's Arabic on top of it just makes it better.
Yeah.
And I don't know why you wouldn't want to push that as a selling point to the movie.
Yeah, well, so it you may not have seen this movie. Not many people did, but it's certainly out there on video, and I think we recommend it. I tell you what, let's sum things up here at the end by going through the four one more time. You want to give a star rating out of five for each one of these, not in terms of how great of an objective quality movie it is, but how much we really like it or appreciate it and recommend it.
Okay, so
Conan the Barbarian,
five out of five. As much as I like it,
I'm going to give Conan the Barbarian four stars, and it mainly because of, like we said, the mythical epic, just the size of it. It seems like a big movie with powerful themes through it, and that takes it from a three to a four for me. Conan the Destroyer,
2.5 or three. I mean, I can't go much higher than three. I mean, it's not the greatest movie. I mean, there's some good stuff that works in it, but it's not great.
Yeah, I agree. There's some stuff that tries to go above three in it, and there's a lot of stuff that tries to go below two, and so it averages out somewhere in there about 2.5, 3. But I'll say this, if you watched Conan the Barbarian and you just want two more hours of Conan, and you don't mind that it kind of gets a little dumber and a little sillier, then just pop that one in and keep rolling, you know? Krull.
Okay, Krull. I know this is going to make me seem like I'm just being a homer, and but it's 4 out of 5 for me. I mean, there's so much I love about that movie and just the characters and the cast, and I am a very big sucker for early James Horner, and his score for that movie is great. And I know whenever I talk to people, they say, you know, he did like 3 or 4 movies in a row that all sound the same. I mean, they have the same instrumentation and the same, you know, tone throughout all of the scores. And I don't care. I love that early James Horner. And I actually own the soundtrack to Krull, and I listen to it all the time when I'm writing. And there's nothing better than the sequence when they're in the swamp and the Slayers come out of the swamp and start attacking them. That music is just awesome. I love it. Mm. So, and that on top of everything else, I mean, it's 4 out of 5.
I'll agree with you. I'll give it a 4. I think just because there's so many neat things to it. It's the main story gets only about a 2.5 to 3 from me. But when you add all the stuff that doesn't have to be there, but is like ornamentation just hanging on it like a Christmas tree, that actually boosts it up to a 4, and it really is a special movie. All right, and The 13th Warrior. And don't worry about hurting my feelings if you don't like it as much as I do.
I mean, 3.5 or 4 out of 5. I mean, it's really a great movie, and I love watching that movie. And, you know, I hate that it wasn't as big of a hit as it should have been, because there's a lot that really works with that movie.
It has perennially been in my top 5 or 6 movies of all time, and it gets a solid 5 stars from me because I dearly, dearly love this movie. I've watched it twice just in the last week. It's one of those movies I can just watch over and over and never get tired of. So, all right. Well, there's your 4 movies to go out and see if you haven't seen all of them. We're going to go ahead and wrap up for today. Jim, tell them again how to find your website and your cool stuff.
They can find all of my cool stuff at midnight-entertainment.com. Or you can find me on Facebook. And actually, the 15th anniversary of The Swindlers of Doom is on Amazon probably as we speak.
There you go. Go
Amazon and The Swindlers of Doom.
Go get that. Absolutely good stuff. We're going to have to do another show sometime and pick up some of the other ones we've missed. I do want to talk about The Sword and the Sorcerer. It's not exactly a quest movie. It's a little bit different from some of these, but it's another one of these 80s fantasy, you know, warriors and wizards and monsters movies that we'll have to throw in there. I'm sure there's 2 or 3 more we can come up with. What you want to do on my end is go to www.whiterocketbooks.com. I've got a brand new novella that just came out this past week called Cold Lightning, which fits into my shattering space opera universe along with the Legion, the 3 Legion books, Lords of Fire, Sons of Terra, and Kings of Oblivion. And it's also available as a limited edition hardcover that's signed and numbered. So you can get it on Kindle, or you can pick up the hardcover and see all the other stuff there at whiterocketbooks.com, including stuff from some other authors as well. So I guess the rocket's going to get on out of here for another week. Jim, I appreciate you coming on and fairly short notice when the mood struck me to talk about these movies. You're always game to play with the fun toys out there in the movie box, and I appreciate that.
You know I'm here whenever you need me.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap up, and we will see you all down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.